Welcome to the Peak Work Performance Summit, where we talk about scientifically proven ideas that make us smarter, healthier, and more productive. My name is Ron Friedman, and my guest today is best-selling author Gretchen Rubin. Gretchen has written a number of entertaining titles, many of which have appeared on the New York Times bestsellers list, including The Happiness Project, Happier at Home, and most recently, Better Than Before. She's also the host of a very popular and engaging new podcast called Happier with Gretchen Rubin. In her new book, Gretchen writes about the science of habits. Now, when many people hear the word habit, they tend to think of negative behaviors like smoking or drinking. But Gretchen argues that there's a whole other side of habits that often gets overlooked. I began by asking her to tell us about the positive side of habits and why she thinks recalibrating our habits at work just might be the single most important thing that we can do to achieve success. Here's what she had to say.
You know, research shows that about 40% of what we do every day is shaped by our habits. So if we have habits that work for us, we're far more likely to be happier, healthier, and more productive. If we have habits that don't work for us, that's going to be much harder. Habits shape our existence, and of course, they shape our future. Now, it's funny that you say that many people, like you first, your first thought is to think of the bad habits. And that's one of the things that surprised me when I was writing Better Than Before, is that oftentimes people would say to me, well, but the thing is, there's so many negative connotations to the idea of habits. But it's, for me, I love habits. And to me, habits had a very positive connotation. And that's one of the things that I learned about and got me curious about habits as I was getting into the research is, well, people have different habits. They have different aptitude for forming habits, and they also have very different attitude towards habits. And that's obviously going to shape the way that you're going to be able to master your habits.
So can you give us an example of a positive habit?
Well, positive habits, anything that works for you. And one of the things that I really found is that there is no magic one size fits all solution. There's no magic. There's no habit that's sort of a universal, a specific habit. I mean, there's the big habit of like knowing yourself, which I would say is true for everyone. But like, let's say, you know, a lot of times the habit experts will throw out these ideas like do it first thing in the morning, give yourself a cheat day, do it for 30 days, start small. And those all sound like good ideas, and they work sometimes for some people, but they don't work all the time for everyone. So you really have to think about what's true for you. So one thing, for example, for me, a habit that I love and that has really made me a lot happier is that I gave up sugar. I really don't need any sugar. For a lot of people, that wouldn't be a good habit. That wouldn't be the right approach for them. I talk about the difference between abstainers and moderators. And so I think that you really have to think about what's going to work for you, what's going to be the good habit for you, because searching for universals can be tricky unless it's something really, really super basic like get enough sleep. That's a good basic universal, get enough sleep.
So before we get into the different types of personalities that might dictate the types of habits and how we form them, one of the things I really liked about what you wrote at the beginning of Better Than Before is this idea that when we have a habit, it really kind of eliminates the need for self-control.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you're absolutely right. Habits are freeing and energizing because they get us out of the draining, difficult business of using our self-control and also making decisions. And so, you know, you could spend a good hour and wear out your self-control and make yourself crazy trying to decide whether to go to the gym in the morning. Should I go today? Should I go tomorrow? I went yesterday. Maybe I get a day off. Oh, it's raining. Oh, my foot hurts. Oh, I've been so good. I deserve a day off. Oh, I won't go in the morning. I'll go later. Not exactly sure when, but I'm sure I'll get around to it. You know, you can just deplete yourself with this kind of self-talk. And the thing about a habit is it just gets you out of that. You know, you don't spend a lot of mental energy deciding whether to brush your teeth, and you don't have to and you can use the same kind of thing for something like going to the gym. Anything that you want to do on a regular basis, the more it becomes a habit, the quicker and more easily it will follow because you've put that behavior on autopilot.
All right. So let's say I'm interested in going to the gym 3 times a week and okay. I want to rule out this idea of my foot hurting as an excuse. Okay. So how do I get myself going to the gym?
Well, it really depends. I mean, I have to ask you a lot of questions. Do you want to get into it?
I'll get into it, sure.
Okay. So you want to go to the gym 3 times a week. When exactly are you going to go? That's the strategy of scheduling. Put it on the schedule. When exactly are you going to go?
Okay. So let's say 5:30.
5:30 in the afternoon or 5:30 in the morning?
Afternoon.
Okay. And are you going to be able to stick to that?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking you.
Well, okay. In the past, if you've made an appointment like that, have you been pretty good about sticking to it?
Yeah. I guess this has really become kind of a therapy session. So I guess for me, the issue is 5:30 going to the gym sounds great, but getting a few more emails out also sounds great.
Okay. Do you tend to do better when there's accountability? Like if you were going to work out with a friend who you're meeting, or you're going to work out with a trainer, you're going to take a class where they take attendance. Does something like that make you more likely to show up?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So what form of external accountability do you imagine that you could build into those three times of going to the gym?
Okay. So the idea is to find someone else who's holding you accountable, not just yourself.
Some people need that, and many people find it helpful. Not everybody needs it, but some people absolutely 100% need it. And then for some people, that actually is a turnoff. Like the idea that somebody's expecting them to go is going to make them even less likely to go. So you have to know what kind of person you are. For me, the idea that there's external accountability doesn't really matter for someone like me. I might like it. It might be useful. It doesn't really make a difference. But for some people, it really makes a difference. So you're saying that you think for you, it would really make a difference. Okay. So you need to come up with that form of external accountability. Now, there's also, what kind of exercise are you going to be doing at the gym, do you suppose?
I like racquetball. I like swimming.
Okay. So racquetball, you're going to play that with somebody else, right?
Yes.
And do you know who you're going to play with?
Well, it would depend different times of week. But yeah, I mean, I have a few people who I play with, so yes.
Okay, so that's the strategy of clarity. The strategy of clarity is, do we have very clearly in our minds what we're expecting of ourselves and how we're going to follow through? So the idea of playing racquetball, it's like, that's going to be a little bit tricky, right? Because you're going to have to cooperate with other people and set that up. On the other hand, it might be more fun, because when we do things with other people, it tends to be more fun. And if somebody is like meeting you at the gym to play racquetball, they're going to be annoyed if you're not there. So that's going to be a form of accountability. So that's good. So swimming. Would you ever do something like the stationary bike or the treadmill, something like that?
No, unlikely.
Not like that. Because one of the things that works for people who do that kind of exercise is something called pairing. And you can do pairing with anything, which is just that if there's something that you want or need to do, something that you like or need to do, you pair it with something that you want to do. So if you really love Game of Thrones, you might say, well, I'm only going to watch Game of Thrones when I'm at the gym. Or my favorite podcast. Now I have a podcast, Happier with Gretchen Rubin. And a lot of people say, oh, well, I listen to your podcast when I'm going for my daily walk. And it's like those two things only go together. And it makes you more inclined to stick to a good habit because there's something that you like or want to do. Now, one thing I did about going to the gym when I was in college, is that I would only allow myself to take a shower if I'd gone to the gym. And that means, like, if you want to take a shower, you got to go to the gym. You end up going pretty often. So another thing is convenience and inconvenience. We are massively influenced by how convenient or inconvenient it is for us to follow through with a habit. So how convenient is it for you to go to the gym?
It's pretty convenient.
It's pretty convenient. And can you make it more convenient? Like, could you get a locker? Or could you get a double set of clothes? Or you need to make these appointments with people to play racquetball. Can you somehow set that up so that that's going to be more convenient? You're not going to be like, ugh, I can't even deal with trying to schedule with Pat to make a game. So I'm just not going to do it. And since I don't have a game, I'm just not going to go. Like, is there a way to make that kind of commitment easier and more convenient?
Yeah, I really like those tips. So one thing I could do, for example, is I can get a locker, and part of the service that the gym provides is that they actually take the clothes that are soiled and then will clean them for you. That makes it easier. And the other thing, applying some of the ideas that you're suggesting here is just having a standing game every Tuesday, for example.
Yes, 100%. Yes, that would be the ideal. So then there's no logistics, there's no discussion. The assumption is I'll be there, you'll be there. And we don't have to talk about it. No, and like as a person who hates to spend money, I really resisted getting a locker for a long time because I'm like, I just live a few blocks from the gym. But it actually makes it a lot more convenient, and it's much easier, when you're out and about to go to the gym. So that if you have the money, it's a good place to throw money at the problem. Right. Now, and you've already talked about the strategy of other people, which is how can we enlist other people into our habits. So you have a friend that you're going to play racquetball with, so that person's going to make it easier for you to exercise. Are there other ways that you could bring other people into this in a way that would make it easier? Or are there potentially people who are going to be undermining this? Are there going to be coworkers who are going to be like, wait a minute, hey, can I just talk to you for 10 minutes? Or like, you know, or a significant other who's going to be like, oh, you know, I really need you to do this for me before you head, you know, like, can you think about how other people could play either a bolstering role or an undermining role?
Right. So identifying people who might stand in the way and then figuring out how I'm going to deal with that.
If yes.
that's at the time of my being at the gym.
Right. Or getting to the gym because one of the strategies is the strategy of other people, thinking about how other people are influencing us. And one is the strategy of safeguards. The strategy of safeguards is think about everything that might get in your way when you're trying to form that habit. Like, you go on vacation, you get sick, your kid gets sick, you know, your racquetball partner doesn't show up. What's your plan for that? If you plan to go to racquetball and at the last minute there's a cancel, are you going to go to the gym anyway and do something else? Does that mean you're off the hook? Like, you know, so you want to have the strategy of safeguards so that you plan for failure. You anticipate stumbling blocks so that when something comes up, you're like, oh, okay, I know what my plan B is here. Because a lot of times we feel committed to a good habit, but we stumble and we don't figure out how to get back in the saddle. And that's also related to the strategy of loopholes. And because there's all these, I identified 10 categories of loopholes that we tend to use when we're trying to let ourselves off the hook. So you're like, oh yeah, you know, I totally mean to go to the gym. And yeah, I'm committed to going 3 times a week, except that, you know what? I couldn't help it because I got this important email, so I couldn't leave my desk. Or I was so good last week, I went all 3 times, so this, I think I deserve a day off. Or I'm going to be so good next week, I think I deserve a day off today. Or you know, oh, it's going to hurt somebody's feelings if I don't show up, you know, to do this thing right away. I can't go a little late, I need to be there right on time. Or you only live once, like it's such a beautiful day, who wants to be inside a gym? I should be, you know, outside taking a nap in the park. These are all different categories of loopholes. Once you're aware of loopholes, and most of us have a couple favorites, then you can be on guard when you're trying to come up with a reason to let yourself off the hook.
So it sounds like you've got a lot of great strategies. So it starts with figuring out what it is you're trying to do, plan a specific time around when you'd like to do it, and then make it as
well. The first thing to do is to figure out what's true for you, because different things work for different people. So there is this tiny group of people who I call rebels for whom putting it on the calendar is actually a negative. So I wouldn't say, hey, everybody should put it on the calendar, because actually, if you are a rebel and you see it on your calendar, you're going to be like, hey, you know what? Just watch me not go. And they won't go. They could sign up for class, they're not going to go for class. For them, they need to feel like it. They need to be choosing. They need to be feeling like they're acting from freedom. So for most people, that's very helpful, but I wouldn't say for everybody it's helpful, because for some people, it's actually counterproductive to put something on the calendar.
So how do I know my type?
Well, most people can tell, like if I just give a quick overview, most people can tell pretty quickly. I also have a quiz on my site, gretchenrubin.com, where you can take a quiz to find out your tendency. Uh-huh. I call this framework the 4 tendencies, and it has a lot of implications for habits. And so with the 4 tendencies, it has to do with how you meet an expectation. And so there's upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. So, and it has to do with how you read an outer expectation, like a work deadline or request from a spouse, or an inner expectation, like your own New Year's resolution or your own desire to go to the gym. Mm-hmm. So upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations. They meet a work deadline, they keep a New Year's resolution without much fuss. And their expectations for themselves are just as important as the expectations of others. Next are questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do something only if they think it makes sense. They hate anything arbitrary or irrational or unfair. And so if they endorse something, they'll do it. But if they don't really believe in it, they won't. Then obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. Like a friend of mine who said, well, I want to exercise. And when I was in high school, I was on the track team and I never missed track practice, but I can't go running now, because when she had a team and a coach, she had no trouble showing up, outer expectations, but her own inner expectation wasn't enough to get her to follow through. those are the people for whom accountability is so important, as we were talking earlier about accountability. And then finally, rebel. Rebel resists all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do when they want to do it in their own way. And if you ask or tell them to do something, they're very likely to resist. So for them, something like, I'm signing you up for a weekly spin class, that would be the opposite of helpful for a rebel, because they would just say, you're not the boss of me, you can't make me, I'm not going to go. So knowing your tendency is very helpful in knowing what you need in order to support your good habits. For an obliger, the external accountability is absolutely crucial. For a questioner, something like understanding why this matters is very crucial. Like if they're going to do a certain kind of exercise, why is this exercise make sense? Why is it efficient? Is it medically shown to be effective? Why am I buying into this system? That's very important for them. So it sort of plays out in different ways depending on what your tendency is.
So good stuff. So you've really narrowed it down to what is your personality type, and then how do you build your habits around your personality rather than simply having a one size fits all solution.
Right, because and there's many things. This is one aspect of your personality, but there's many things that come into play. And I just think that a lot of times we get discouraged about our habits because we think like, oh, I tried this and I failed. I keep trying to get myself to go to the gym and I don't succeed. So I have no self-control. I have no willpower. Like, what's wrong with me? Whereas in fact, if you set it up in a way that's right for you, you're going to have much, much better success. One way that this comes up a lot is with morning people and night people. You know, if you're going to try to go for a run, you know, if you're a morning person, it might make sense to go before work. If you're a night person, that is not a good idea. You're not going to be successful if you're trying to get up early to go for a run. You can barely get out of bed in time to get to work. If you're an obliger, you really need a form of external accountability. That for you is crucial. For other people, maybe that's helpful, but not necessary. So you really want to start by thinking about all the things that are true for you. One thing that's helpful to think about is, when have you succeeded in the past? Like, was there a time when you did have this habit successfully? And then thinking about like, well, what was different then from what's different now? And then a lot of times you can find out, and I try to identify those elements because I think sometimes people don't understand why something worked at one time and is not working at another. They kind of misattribute the problem. And I try to point out like what the crucial things are to think about.
We're going to make the four tendencies quiz available to folks on this page. Now let's say I'm interested in helping a colleague develop habits. What do I do? Do I take the quiz with him or her in mind?
Well, that's really interesting because that's a lot of people are interested in that, as you can imagine, which is changing someone else's habits. It's really helpful to know someone else's tendency. And I have to say, you know, for myself, this has been hugely helpful. Now, this framework that I came up with never existed before. I came up and it just about, you know, blew my brain. It was so hard to understand this, to grasp this pattern in human nature. And the funny thing is, when I started writing Better Than Before, I figured I was a pretty typical personality. I thought I was pretty average. Well, it turns out I'm actually on the freaky fringe. I'm an upholder, and that's a very, very small tendency. Very few people are rebels or upholders. Those are kind of the freaky fringes. And what I learned about myself is that upholders generally tend to have a lot of impatience with other people because we're like, well, we keep expectations pretty easily. Like, what's the big deal for you? So now I see like, oh, if I know someone's an obliger, then there really needs to be a form of external accountability. However, that's built in. Like, I just understand that. Or when my husband's a questioner, if I want him to do something, I need to explain why I want him to do it. It's not enough for him. If he just asked me to do something, I would do it. For an upholder, that's enough. But he's like, why am I going to do that? Why am I going to do that? Why am I going to do that now? You know, I just have to say to him, this is why. And so it leads to a lot less conflict. And certainly you see this in at work situations where, you know, like a manager, an upholder manager might not understand why obligers need deadlines and supervision. Or an obliger manager might not understand why everything they do makes a rebel less and less and less likely to cooperate. Or, questioners in workplaces, they can be great because they're the ones who are saying, is this the best way to do it? Why are we writing this report anyway? Maybe we should be using this format. Maybe we should change software. That's positive. But sometimes they exhaust other people with their questioning. Sometimes they exhaust themselves with their questioning because they sort of can't, they sometimes have analysis paralysis because they want more and more information. And so if you understand where everybody's coming from and kind of what they need to move forward, then it's much easier to manage conflict and to take advantage of the strengths of everyone's tendency and to figure out ways to counterbalance the negatives.
So how do I understand them?
You know, I think for most people, when you work with somebody pretty closely, you start to see a pattern pretty clearly. I think when just hearing about the four tendencies, people pretty quickly sort themselves into groups and will know what other people are. It's pretty apparent once you hear it. And of course, the more extreme the personality, the more obvious it is, and the more of an issue it becomes. So if someone's a really extreme questioner, you're going to notice that, because that is going to be really part of their behavior. And the minute that, but you maybe didn't pinpoint it enough to be able to see how it might relate to other things. So I feel like people pretty much get it. Or you could have them take the quiz and ask them what, and figure out what they are that way.
Interesting. And, you know, it might actually be a good exercise to have your team take the quiz together. It can actually spark some interesting discussion.
I think that's absolutely true. People are really fascinated by this. I did a fun exercise where I was speaking to a large group, and I had a little extra more time than I usually do. So I had the four groups divide into their groups. And so there were like two rebels, eight upholders, and then the questioners and obligers. Those groups were so big they had to split into two groups each because there were so many. But I had them just talk amongst themselves. And it was like, you know, somebody was like, at last I found my people. And they were all just like so interested in talking to people who saw the world exactly the way that they did. But of course, it might have been very interesting to have groups where there was one of each kind and really say like, well, how does this make you feel? What is your reaction when the boss says, we need to have this report by Friday, when you know that boss isn't going to look at it until Wednesday? What do you think about that? How does that influence your thinking? Because sometimes all you need to do to manage a conflict is to understand how somebody else is coming to it. It's so easy to just assume that everybody sees the world in our way, or that they should see the world in our way. But when you see how they're coming at it with a different mindset, then you can find that place where everyone can come together. Because they are very different ways of seeing the world.
Interesting. So, all right. So we've talked about building some positive habits. What about if I want to get rid of a bad habit? What if every time I'm on a conference call, I can't help but check my email, and it's a habit I really desperately want to break. What should I do?
Well, you use the same 21 strategies to make or break a habit. So it's the same. You use the same strategies, whatever you're doing. And so, again, the first thing is the strategy of clarity, which is exactly what are you trying to do? So you don't want to check. So you're on a conference call. How are you checking your email?
On my phone.
On your phone. So what if you put your phone, you turned your phone off and put it in a drawer in another room?
All right. So that's easy. So what about?
Yeah, I mean, just make it inconvenient. I mean, a lot of times people are like, I want to get off my cell phone, but I also want to carry it in the back pocket of my jeans. It's like, you know what? You're not going to say no to that cell phone when it's in your back pocket. It's very easy. Don't try to control your mind, your motivation, your emotional state. Control your circumstances. If you put that cell phone someplace where it's out of your reach and it's hard to get to, and it's very inconvenient, again, that's the strategy of inconvenience, then you're going to have a much better time, much easier time not checking your email.
Pushback that I get a lot on that is, well, I need to stay in touch with my family. So if they're texting me over the course of the workday, I need to be available to them. So I can't get rid of my phone. What do I do then?
Well, I mean, this is very different. Are you talking about not having it during a conference call or not having it during the whole entire day?
Well, I think even from the perspective of, you know, a lot of times at work, you're brought into a 2-hour conference call and you can't just not have your phone with you.
Right. Well, that's one. I'm a big believer in if you're going to have a long meeting, saying in the middle, we're going to have a break so everybody can check their phones. Because a lot of times if people know they can check their phone, then they're not always surreptitiously. They think, by the way, we all know they're checking their phones, so that they know that they can check in. Because I think you're right. For some people, they really feel like it's legitimate. So here's the question. This is where it gets to the strategy of clarity. Do you feel like it's a legitimate thing that you want to do, or do you feel like it's something you don't want to do? Because if you keep saying like, well, I don't want to check my email, and yet I think I should be able to check my email, well, what are you asking of yourself? Are you saying you want to check your email and you think that's good, and that's something that you need to do and that you want to do? Or are you saying you don't want to check your email? I think a lot of times people, they're sort of in this state where they're like, I want to be free from my email and yet be checking it all the time. What do you want? So if you want to be checking your email periodically, then maybe you want to check it, you know, at the very end of every hour. You want to check in periodically, but you don't want to check it constantly.
I really like that idea of saying, hey, everybody, let's just admit the fact that we're interested in checking the emails and not pretend that we can have these calls for 2 to 3 hours.
Right. And just have a break and say, well, we're going to have a 10-minute break anyway. We're going to have a break where everybody can kind of catch up with wherever they are. And then people know that they can. And then they're not constantly. I mean, a lot of times people check their phones because they're sort of bored. If you're checking your phone because you're sort of bored, that's very different from, oh, I just got a text from my daughter's school, and so I feel like I really have to look at what it says. And I think part of it is being honest with yourself. Like, why are you really doing it? And what's really going on with that behavior? And of course, people are in very different situations in terms of how much urgency they experience at their job. And is it true urgency or is it fake urgency? So this is a fun thing to think about. Imagine if you feel like you're under constant stress at work, imagine that you are someone different and you have a totally different job. So I would imagine that I am a heart surgeon. Okay, I'm a heart surgeon and I'm thinking, Gretchen Rubin's life, is that stressful? Is that a person that needs to check her phone every half an hour? I would say no. There's something about being in our own experience where like, oh, everything's incredibly important and vital. But then when you imagine it from the outside, you're like, nah, I think I could go a half an hour without checking my phone. And I think the more you check it, the more you create a sense of your sense in yourself that you have to check it. And the more you lengthen that time, the more you realize, you know what, nothing's happening in an hour that can't wait an hour for you to get back on your phone or 6 hours or however it is that you want to parcel it out.
Right. So how has writing a book on habits changed the way that you work?
Well, one of the things I found out is I had pretty good habits to begin with, which is, I'm sure, one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book, because I have such an aptitude for habits and such a good feeling about habits. One thing is I've increasingly over the years become more and more of a believer in the power of sleep. And I now am just very, very focused on getting enough sleep. And especially this is true if what you're working with is your mind, because if what you've got, the only thing I have is my mind. And if that is not working at top performance, then I'm the only one who suffers, and so I really am very focused on that. What else? I've done so many habits. Little things like running down the stairs instead of just walking down the stairs, because it's very energizing to get feet off the ground. It's very childlike, very sort of playful. I tried meditation for like 5 months. I had the habit of meditation. I successfully had the habit of meditation, but I have to confess that meditation made me kind of crazy. Like, it did not make me feel calmer and more like with more clarity of mind and more mindfulness. It was actually, the opposite. So that was something I was all excited to. I'm like, oh, I'm finally going to be one of those people that meditates. Everybody says it's so amazing. I'm really excited about this. And I tried, but I just couldn't get it to work. But maybe I'll try again.
I have to tell you, I can relate to that experience of meditation being kind of stressful. But I think there are different types of meditation that you can do to fit your personality type. Maybe that's a topic for a different blog or another book. But
yeah.
So tell us about sleep. What have you done to get more sleep?
Well, part of it is the strategy of monitoring. And the monitoring is kind of a magical thing where we tend to do a better job with just about any behavior if we monitor it. So if you want to eat more healthfully, keep a food journal. If you want to get more exercise, use a step counter. If you want to stick to a budget, track your spending. And same thing. So I used a Jawbone Up Band to keep track of when I went to sleep. And what I realized is, even though I am a sleep zealot and I was a deep believer in sleep, I was underestimating how much sleep I got, because we tend to have fun remembering all the times we do things right and then kind of discount the number of times we do things wrong. And so monitoring really helped me to stick to it. And then also, my bedtime essentially is 10:30. So if it's 10, I might go to sleep earlier if I'm sleepy, but at 10:30, I start thinking it's my bedtime. And if it's 11 o'clock, I'm up at half an hour past my bedtime. And so I really started paying much more attention at night to what time it was, because I sort of go into a zone and I don't really know exactly what time it is. Now I try to be more attentive to it so I can do it. And also, one thing that I did that that was surprisingly useful is I found that sometimes I would be so tired that I didn't want to go to bed because it seemed like too much trouble to get ready, like take out my contacts, wash my face, brush my teeth. It all just seemed like, oh, I can't. So I would just stay up, which of course is crazy. So now I try to get ready for bed earlier, so that when I am ready to go to bed, I there's very little I need to do. I'm already ready for bed earlier. And here's one thing that I did not expect. One piece of advice that you often see, which frankly I thought was seemed too good to be true, which was to brush your teeth after you eat dinner as a way to end night snacking. I have to say, this is at least for me, was amazingly effective. There's something about brushing your teeth where it's sort of like your body's like, okay, well, we're done with that now and it's over. And I was a big night snacker, and this made made it a lot easier. It was just like, it didn't cross my mind to eat somehow. There's something about that habit and kind of cleaning out your mouth that I found. So getting ready for bed earlier had two consequences. One I expected, which was easier to go to sleep, but then also this kind of bonus benefit, which was that it really helped me cut down on night snacking.
Very interesting. I you know, it's interesting. I also had, I used a Fitbit to my.
Oh yeah. So same difference. Yeah.
And some things that I noticed is that I would get to bed later every night during the week, whereas Friday night was actually the lowest amount of sleep I got every week. And it's because going to sleep requires effort.
Yes.
Like you described. And so when you, it's actually at the point of your day where you have the least amount of energy left.
Yes. That's an excellent point. I never thought about that, but it's true. It's like so much, and that's the strategy of foundation. The strategy of foundation is there's certain elements of life that go right to our self-mastery. So it's eating and drinking right, sleeping, moving around, and uncluttering. Weirdly, that's sort of kind of one of the sort of an odd one, but it seems to really make a difference. But those go directly to self-mastery. And you're exactly right. When you're exhausted, you can't use the self-mastery that you need to get more sleep. And so it's sort of this horrible downward cycle, which is because you don't have the self-mastery, you just dig yourself in deeper and deeper. And that's sort of this poetic justice, this cruel poetic justice of habits, which is so often we're punished for the bad habit by the habit itself. Like, what is the punishment of not getting enough sleep? You get even less sleep. What's the, you know, and they've done studies where like women who are very worried about their weight try to make themselves, they comfort themselves by eating, or gamblers who are very concerned about their finances try to cheer themselves by going gambling. So a lot of times, like, you got to break that negative cycle of a habit, because it tends to, you know, these things that we want to do to make ourselves feel better end up just making us feel worse. So you want to make sure you don't get into that.
I recently heard an interview with you where you talk about how you very deliberately split up your day into three chunks. So you've got an original writing chunk, a blog writing chunk, and an email writing chunk. And yeah. I wonder if you could tell us about why it is that you split up your day in that way.
Well, the original writing chunk is I go out of my apartment to do it, and so that I get away from the internet. Because again, it's like, don't keep your phone in your back pocket, put it far away. I'm like, I'm not, you know, in my office, I have three monitors and I've got everything wired up. But if I go to this little library a block from my house, then I just don't connect to anything. And so I can really, really focus. And so that's a big chunk. And that's I consider my highest value of work. So I try to do that in the time of day where I'm going to be I'm a morning person, so the freshest and most energetic. I try to keep that as low in the day as possible.
Before you go on, why do you need three monitors?
Three monitors are amazing. Well, I mean, maybe some people have those giant monitors where they can have like six panels, but I have three monitors, so I can have three screens up. And a lot of people think, oh, that would be bad, it's multitasking, but actually it's a huge time saver. I got it because I read a study that said that information workers, which I guess I'm one, like their productivity jumped dramatically when they had three monitors. And it's true, because I can have let's say I'm working on a document and I want to paste something in from another document, or like, let's say I'm writing something about the four tendencies and somebody sent me a really interesting email example and I'm like, ooh, I want to incorporate that person's comment into my document. I don't have to click, 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 click. I can just swipe it through. Hmm. So for me, that allows me to move between lots of different ideas, or like I see an interesting thing on Twitter, I can look it up in my browser or whatever. But then when I need to do original writing, I want the opposite experience. I want to be very focused on what's on my screen. And so I have to go. So I go to my, you know, the library, and there's no talking permitted in my library. I mean, and they really enforce it. I mean, people practically like grab you out with a hook if you like don't turn off the, you know, if your laptop isn't on silent. And so that's a very different kind of mindset. But with email and my blog writing, that tends to be much more like I'll sit down and go through a bunch of them, but I don't have it as discrete. Like that's not as carved out. It's just like, oh, I have this time to do this now. Oh, I have this time to do this now. A lot of it is managing my mental energy. Like how much intellectual firepower do I need to do this task, and try to But I will say I do something which all the habit experts tell you not to do, which is I begin my day with a very low form of work, which is I begin my day with a solid hour of email and social media. I found that I just can't focus on anything bigger and more abstract until I clear the decks. Like if I don't know what's happened in my email, and also I have something called quitting time. This is good for people who want leisure, which is at a certain point every night I have quitting time and I don't check my emails anymore and I don't do anything more for work so that I really have a feeling of leisure. So I won't read something for work. I won't review a document. I won't check my email. And so often, you know, I have many, many hours of unexamined email by the time I get up at 6 a.m. and I always get up at 6 a.m. every single day. So I like to go through that because it just, otherwise it just nags at me, even though that's sort of not what you're supposed to do, but that's what works for me. That's the key thing.
I have to tell you about this idea of that's not what you're supposed to do. I think it's in many cases unrealistic, not
to
check your email first thing in the morning. And the other thing is I noticed that for you, you have a different space associated with that high focus work. And so you have that separation, and just that walk over to the library, I'm sure makes a big difference.
Huge. Huge. And it's also kind of a, you know, I can't remember if it was John Cheever, some writer like got dressed up in like, you know, suit pants and a button down shirt and like walked around his house before he sat down at his desk. I'll have to look up and see who it was. But it was sort of the idea that you needed to be suited up for work and you needed some kind of commute, however small. And I'm a big believer in that, in that use your circumstances to put you into a certain state of mind or to cue certain habits. And then also, you know, what I found is that working is one of the most dangerous forms of procrastination. And if I'm in my office, in my home, there are so many things that I can do that are like, you know, productive that are not as productive as doing original writing, which is my highest and best form of work. And so, you know, I'll file or I'll print some documents out or I'll answer some emails or I'll do a little research. That's my big temptation, is doing research. I love to do research, you know, and so it looks productive. It's not like I'm sitting on the couch reading a magazine, and yet it is not doing what it is that I want to do, which, you know, my most valuable thing. And so if you find that working, so when I go to the library, I just say to myself, well, I'm here for 2.5 hours, say, and I'm one day. I'm going to write or nothing. It's write or I'm just going to stare at the stack of books in front of me and I'm just stuck here. And so I end up writing just to pass the time out of sheer boredom. Mm-hmm. But if you allow yourself to be distracted by a lot of other occupations, you know, days and days and days can go by where you're doing a lot of stuff and maybe somebody looking at you from the outside would think that you were being productive, but in fact, you're not making progress on whatever that essential task is. And so like putting aside that time, I'm gonna do this or do nothing. That's the strategy of scheduling. It's very effective, especially for people who are prone to procrastination, which is just about all of us.
Gretchen, thank you very much. This has been excellent. I really
thank you. I feel like we could talk all day. Thank you so much. Yeah.